Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The American Society of Civil Engineers issued its 2017 Infrastructure Report Card. The United States received a D+. Our infrastructure is in very bad shape. The oldest association of civil engineers say the United States has only been paying half of its infrastructure bill for some time. To raise the grade, an estimated $2 trillion 10-year investment gap is needed. Well, last week, at an event marking the Department of Transportation's 50th anniversary, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao said the Trump administration will announce its infrastructure plan later this year. She said the package would be valued at $1 trillion over 10 years and will include energy, water, and potentially broadband and veterans hospitals. The big question is, how will it be funded? Democrats say the plan should be paid for by closing tax loopholes used by corporations and super wealthy individuals. But Chao says the Trump administration's plan will most likely offer tax incentives in exchange for public-private partnerships. So on today's Your Call, we are going to talk about our infrastructure and what these public-private partnerships actually look like, because private equity firms are currently running a lot of infrastructure in the country, including water systems and tolls. Today, we're joined by David Dayan, contributing writer to The Nation and The Intercept. David is author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Kevin DeGood, Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress. His work focuses on how highway, transit, aviation, and maritime policy affects global competitiveness and access to opportunity for diverse communities. And Kevin joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Well, I think it's safe to say that our infrastructure is really a mess. All you have to do is really walk down the street. Here in San Francisco, if you bike, it's almost like you're kind of trying to get past the potholes and prevent yourself from falling. I mean, it's really bad. David, first off, can you just talk about this? The American Society of Civil Engineers just put out their report card that comes out every 4 years, and the United States received a D+. That's like D and D for dog.
Yeah, I think that might be a step up from where the American Society of Civil Engineers has ranked America in terms of its infrastructure. Certainly over the last century, America has gone from really being a world leader in terms of infrastructure to lagging pretty far behind. And, you know, what we have in America is a lot of deferred maintenance. We simply stopped upgrading our infrastructure however many years ago, and instead of spending the money, particularly spending the money when it would have been much cheaper to borrow over the last several years when Federal Reserve interest rates have been very low, this would have been a prime opportunity to both use those low rates to borrow at a much cheaper rate, and also, you know, get some jobs into the American economy. But we blew that opportunity, and now, as I'm sure we'll get into, what President Trump is proposing is far from any kind of real opportunity to really fix our infrastructure, but really a giveaway to investors to try to privatize a number of these programs.
And Kevin, what would you add to that?
Well, I think, you know, he raises a really excellent point, and that is around what we often refer to in this space as the cost of funds. Another way to think about that is, how much does it cost a state or local government to go out and borrow money in order to make the kinds of investments that we all know that we need? And really, at least in part as a result of the Great Recession, we see that interest rates on public sector debt, which we often refer to as muni debt, have been incredibly low. A state or local government right now that has a AAA credit rating can borrow at around 3.2% fixed interest rate over 30 years. And that's a very, very favorable set of terms. That is a cheap pot of money to put your hands on. And we haven't really seen the kinds of building activity that I think we would all like. And I think the lesson to take away from that is that the major constraint facing state and local governments is not access to credit. It's not an inability to borrow. Really, the issue is insufficient tax revenues to repay new project debts. Mm. And so that's part of what makes the Trump plan, and I struggle to even use that word in its current form, but that's part of what really makes this plan, I think, so disappointing is that he was on the campaign trail very much talking about this as though he were going to push the federal government to actually spend $1 trillion. And instead, he's concocted this rather convoluted scheme of private equity capital and public-private partnerships and is trying to pass that off. But again, it's not that our governments can't borrow. It's that they're struggling to repay.
Well, and here in California, this is happening actually right now. A Senate panel yesterday gave first approval to a measure that would raise gas taxes and vehicle fees by $52 billion during the next decade to deal with road and bridge repairs in the state. And $52 billion is a hefty fund, but, I mean, you traveling around Northern California, you can just see things crumbling. And so this would raise gas taxes and vehicle fees. So that's one way to do it. And, of course, this still has to go through committee. But, David, we don't have the specifics on the Trump plan. Elaine Chao, the transportation secretary, says they'll come out with details later in the year. What do we know, though, about how the administration wants to pay for this?
Yeah, the best we can look at is a paper that Wilbur Ross, who's now the Commerce Secretary, and Peter Navarro, who is now in a White House office overseeing trade policy, they wrote a paper during the campaign, and it talked about how this might go. And, you know, President Trump very, very pointedly during his address to Congress said that they would create an infrastructure plan that would produce $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. He didn't say that they would spend $1 trillion, and the paper kind of shows that as well. What they want to do is essentially provide tax breaks to private investors who would then invest and leverage that money up into this infrastructure spending. But, you know, the municipal bond market, which is how a lot of this type of activity is funded today, is a very large market. It's a multi-trillion dollar market. The idea, and it already is tax preferred. I mean, it's mostly tax free on municipal bonds. So the idea that investors would, you know, jump into this opportunity rather than just shifting their spending from municipal bonds to this perhaps better tax break that they would get from the Trump administration is kind of folly. So really you're just seeing a shifting. And, you know, the other problem here is that these private investors aren't going to invest in these projects unless they get some sort of return. And a return on investment can really only be done in the infrastructure space through some sort of user fee, whether it's a toll road or a higher rate for water system usage or something like that. And that's what you see in these private-public partnerships, which is really what the Trump administration wants to do. It leads to a quality of service which is usually very expensive. It can be degraded. It's, you know, basically the selling off of the public commons, the things that we all share and use our tax dollars to spend on, and now they're getting shifted into a private investor scheme.
And you have pointed out that recent projects like the Pocahontas Parkway in Virginia, the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel in Detroit, have led to bankruptcies, and in the aftermath, taxpayers had to step in to pay off the bonds and supply the upkeep.
That's absolutely right, and it just goes down the line. I mean, you can talk about the bankruptcies, of which we've seen a number in this particular public-private partnership space. You can talk about the jacking up of these user fees, whether it's the water systems in Bayonne, New Jersey, or Coatesville, Pennsylvania, or the parking meters in Chicago, Illinois. There are so many examples of these public-private partnerships that lead to worse quality of service, a lot of what happens in these bankruptcies is that they promise these elevated rates of use that do not come true, and then the company who made those promises can't fulfill them, and then they just go out of business, and then the maintenance that was supposed to be done by the private company then has to be, you know, pushed upon the government. And so you just see it really down the line that and I think in the aggregate the studies show that these private use of infrastructure is not as efficient as advertised. You know, the idea is supposed to be that it saves money, but that the jury is way still out on that.
Kevin, you have written extensively about this, and you point out that investors often push for non-compete clauses. These are contract provisions that reduce competition and require the government to make them whole financially when policy changes or infrastructure investment alter project revenues. You write these provisions are smart business but often bad policy. Can you tell us more about these non-compete clauses?
Absolutely. I think it's important to understand that infrastructure behaves a little bit differently than some other parts of our economy. When most of us talk and think about competitive markets or capitalism, we often have rather simple ideas of things like commodities being traded or of one restaurant competing against another. But one of the reasons why the private equity investors want into the infrastructure space is that it has characteristics that are very attractive. Principally, is that there's very little competition. If we're thinking about drinking water or wastewater, there's only one pipe that brings drinking water to your house, and there's only one pipe that takes wastewater away, and that means that it's effectively a monopoly asset. When we're talking about highways, obviously there's a little bit of competition because for every given interstate route, there's often a parallel state route or other more minor road. But if you're traveling any distance or you're trying to commute in the morning, there's probably only one or two ways that you can go. So while it's not a pure monopoly, it has characteristics that make it somewhat similar. And so these firms like infrastructure because it allows them to engage in pricing that is very aggressive. So if I'm trying to travel between Washington, D.C. and New York City, and I'm going to go by car, really the best option there is I-95. So not surprisingly, it's pretty easy for states in this case to leverage tolls on I-95. And so that's part of what investors are looking for. It's the characteristics of these facilities that makes them so attractive. In a sense, they're relatively free of the kind of competitive pressures that push down prices and lower profit margins. To your specific question about non-compete clauses, that's really part of it, is that these companies want to try to insulate themselves over the long arc of the concession agreement. So if you are a private company and you've entered into a 40 or 50 year contract with the state to design, build, operate, and maintain a bridge, a tunnel, a section of highway, whatever it may be, you want to make sure that over the course of that project, the state doesn't then go and spend money on other facilities that might draw traffic away from paying the tolls that you want to charge them. And so what you do is you negotiate these provisions into the deal and you say, well, look, state, it's not that you can't make those investments in parallel facilities, but if you do, and we show that that has drawn traffic away from our project, you have to make us financially whole. And that is a really unique thing. There are very few, if any, other places in the economy where the private sector essentially pushes the government to guarantee a specific level of profitability.
Kevin DeGood is Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress, and David Dayan is Contributing Writer to The Nation and The Intercept. His latest book is called Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. It's a really amazing read. We had David on when his book came out, and you can search for that at yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about what's to come with our infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers' latest report card gave the United States a D+, D as in dog, and the Trump administration has been talking about infrastructure. Trump talked about it a lot on the campaign trail. It's a $1 trillion 10-year plan, and we're getting a few details about it. We'll get a lot more later in the year, but we do know that the administration plans to offer tax cuts in exchange for public-private partnerships. And so we're talking about that, what that would really look like. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. There's also going to be a lot of questions about priority. Where does the money go? What kind of projects will get started? Because so much is needed across the country. Who's going to make those decisions? And then here in California, you definitely want to watch this. A Senate panel just yesterday gave the first approval to a measure that would raise gas taxes and vehicles by $52 billion over the next 10 years to deal with road and bridge repairs. The Democrats have a supermajority, which means they don't need one Republican vote to raise taxes. But based on the articles I've read, moderate Democrats are kind of wary of this because it raises some taxes on gas and vehicle fees. So what are your thoughts on how this should be paid for and what the priority should be? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. David, can you talk about how the administration might deal with what projects to tackle? Because you took part in a debate in a Costco magazine. It was pretty interesting. And you point out that public-private partnerships can cost more than their publicly funded counterparts, but they also ensure projects get funding based on what can reap the most profits. So, for example, a bridge connecting a wealthy suburb where users can afford a large toll makes more sense than a sewage upgrade in a poor rural hamlet or an inner city, for example.
Yeah, that's really an important point of this when you're looking at where the money is going to go. So right now we have the municipal bond market, and there are various state and local public-private partnerships that go on. But as I said, these PPPs are really incumbent upon being able to get a return on that investment through user fees. And it's just a truism that if you're putting this into an area that can afford higher user fees, it's going to be more attractive than an area that cannot. And where we need the most help in terms of our infrastructure is correlated with poorer, more rural, more areas that would be least able to afford higher fees like this. So it's you're creating the Trump administration wants to create this bang for the buck, but it's going to go to precisely the places that we don't need it as much.
Kevin, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think to put this in perspective, the municipal bond market right now has about $3.7 trillion in outstanding issuances. So it's a huge, robust market. There is a great deal of demand for this public sector debt. And so when the Trump administration and others who are supportive of their plan talk about there's private capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to invest, I think, you know, it's important to come back to this notion that there isn't a shortage of project financing. There isn't a shortage of capital. And the money that's being offered is very expensive. So let's put this in context. At 15%, if a state wanted to finance, say, $100 million worth of infrastructure activity, if they were receiving private equity capital and having to provide a 15% annual return, over 30 years, the price tag on that debt jumps up to about $550 million in interest charges. And if we're talking about at 3 or 3.5% municipal bonds, you're looking at maybe $170 million in interest charges. So the difference in the cost of these funds is enormous, which begs the question, why is it that any state or local government or special purpose authority would ever want to engage in a public-private partnership? And the main reason for that is risk transference. PPPs are principally an alternative method of procurement, which is not something that, that most folks spend a lot of time thinking about. But it comes to matter greatly when we're talking about big, complicated pieces of infrastructure. So you're talking about major highways, rail lines, maybe there's tunneling involved, you have to move utilities, there could be wetlands issues. These projects can become quite complicated to deliver. And what a public-private partnership is at its core is a fixed price contract. So the state is saying, in exchange for us paying this premium, what we get is a stronger guarantee that this project will be built and open to the public on time and on budget. But the question that you always have to ask yourself from the public's perspective is, are we paying the appropriate premium for that risk transference? And if you're not, then you've essentially given a huge profit and you haven't gotten much back for that. And part of what this really tells us at the end of the day is that PPPs only work to the extent that they work for mega projects. If we look at the history of the TIFIA loan program at the U.S. Department of Transportation, over the last 25 years, the average project cost of projects that have included some form of equity investment as a public-private partnership has been over $1.25 billion. And so the vast majority of the work that is needed across the country and across sectors are much smaller maintenance projects and incremental improvements to the existing capital base. They're not the kinds of things that fit within that mega project box, even though we often tend to focus on mega projects because they're catalysts for regional change and they tend to be fairly interesting and dynamic and they're easy and fun to think about. But that isn't necessarily the thing that is holding us back nationally from an infrastructure perspective.
We have a few calls on the line. Let's take a few before a break. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Just a couple of questions and a comment. One is that Brown's proposal is going to be a regressive proposal because it's going to impact lower income people in the state of California more than it is upper income people. The thing that I don't, and he wants to fund his high speed rail, I believe, by bonds to the tune of like $50 billion. I think that's the proposal. What I don't understand is why the Democrats, who have controlled the Senate and the Assembly in California, now have a Democratic governor, have not really gone after taxation in the sense that Prop 13 has been saddled, the state's been saddled with this for years. And the Democrats have never really gone after that to try and really make it a more equitable taxation system. And they've now got supermajorities, and unfortunately, that's not the direction they're going in, to try and make things more equitable, try to get funding through taxes that would be progressive rather than regressive. And this Brown thing is just, it's typical of Brown. So I'm not sure what the state Democrats are looking at in terms of trying to resolve that problem.
Well, thank you, Greg. According to the LA Times, if this package is approved by the Senate and the Assembly, the measure would raise the base excise tax on gas by 12 cents a gallon to a total of 30 cents a gallon, raise diesel taxes, and create a new annual vehicle fee that would average $51 based on the value of the car or the truck. David, Dan, what are your thoughts? You live in California. A lot of people are saying that this is a regressive tax.
Well, I think what your caller was talking about represents the relative timidity of the California legislature, particularly the Democrats in the legislature, to really look at a root and branch reform of the taxation system. Right now, it's extremely volatile. It relies on one-time revenues, often revenues that fluctuate with stock values largely, because there hasn't been an effort to reform, as your caller mentioned, Prop 13, which significantly constrains the amount of money in property taxes that can be received, both from residential structures, but more prominently from commercial structures. It really lowers those rates. So, yes, I generally agree that there's a relative disinterest in really looking at the structures that are, making it problematic for California to have the tax base that it really, once, if you're talking about the services that the public seems to want it to provide. Just briefly on the previous comments regarding public-private partnerships, I do think that there's a relationship that dovetails these things with the short-term nature of politics. So politicians can say, okay, I can sell off the water system and this will get me a short-term benefit and you know, help me straighten my budget situation out in the short term, but consumers will pay the price 20, 30, 50, 100 years down the road. So it's almost tailor-made for someone who's only looking towards the next election rather than down the road at what the cost, the ultimate cost, will be borne upon the residents of this municipality or state or whatever over the long term. So that's really one of the political problems, I think, with this particular issue.
Thank you for calling in, Greg. And if you want to make your voice heard on this transportation package here in California, the Senate is expected to vote on it on Thursday. And you can find information about this at yourcallradio.org. David Dan, quick thoughts before we let you go on this Trump infrastructure plan. How are you covering this?
Gingerly. I don't know that there's a whole lot that's advanced beyond talk. Certainly I'm looking into, you know, covering the whole notion of private, public-private partnerships and what their real impact is on communities. There's been some talk that Trump will combine this infrastructure package with a larger tax cut package that he wants to do, and potentially that would accelerate the timeline for when this gets done. But now we're hearing about healthcare getting back into the conversation. There are a lot of other deadlines that Congress needs to meet. It's going to be difficult to see infrastructure moved up in the queue, especially because Republicans in Congress don't seem to have a whole lot of appetite for it. They feel like they've already passed a five-year transportation plan last year, and the idea of this Congress spending any money, even if it's certainly not $1 trillion, but there would be some startup costs involved, something on the order of $130 billion. The idea of this Congress even spending that is a little bit fanciful. So it's we haven't seen a whole lot of legislative forward motion from the Trump administration. And this one seems to be a particularly heavy lift.
Well, David, thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
David Dayan is contributing writer for The Nation and The Intercept. He's author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. You can find the interview we did with David about that book at yourcallradio.org. After the break, we'll continue speaking with Kevin DeGood, Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress, and we will talk about what happened when Chicago decided to lease its parking meters to a fund managed by Morgan Stanley for $1 billion back in 2008. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, new to the KLW lineup from WBUR in Boston, it's On Point with your host, Tom Ashbrook. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the state of our infrastructure and what we can expect from the Trump administration's $1 trillion 10-year plan. The American Society of Civil Engineers comes out with a report card every 4 years, and it just came out with its new one. The United States got a D+, that's D like dog, and they've got really good videos on their website explaining how they came up with this. The infrastructure, whether you're talking about roads or water, just needs so many repairs, and the civil engineers say the United States has only been paying about half of its bill for some time. To raise the grade, they believe that $2 trillion is needed. It's a $2 trillion 10-year investment. So today we're talking about the state of our infrastructure and how this plan should be paid for. We don't know details about the Trump administration's plan, but we do know that they are calling for tax incentives in exchange for public-private partnerships. The Democrats, on the other hand, in Washington, D.C., say the plan should be paid for by closing tax loopholes used by corporations and super wealthy individuals. And we're talking about this with Kevin DeGood. He's director of infrastructure policy at the Center for American Progress. And he writes about highways, transit, aviation, and how that affects access to opportunity for diverse communities and environmental sustainability. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How do you think this should be paid for, and what about priorities? Let's hear next from Henry in Richmond. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I'm all for California raising the taxes and doing as much as we can paying for it ourselves. These public-private partnerships, particularly with Trump, they are going to go to, there could be sweetheart deals, and the public will be damned, and the private companies will be making tons, and they'll be not doing the projects that we really need. It's going to be really bad. So I say, remember, we were paying almost $5 a gallon not long ago? I think we should just slap a dollar on and go for it. You know, people want to be buying more fuel-efficient cars and forget about worrying about all these, oh, it's going to hurt everybody, blah, blah, blah. We got to pay. Thank you.
Thank you. If you weren't tuned in earlier, the California Senate government really is planning to raise gas taxes and vehicle fees by $52 billion over the next decade for road and bridge repairs. A Senate panel approved the measure yesterday, and the full Senate is expected to vote on Thursday. So if you want to make your voices heard, now is the time. Kevin, let's talk about more specific examples and what we might expect from a Trump administration. Can you tell us what happened back in 2008, when Chicago agreed to lease its parking meter system to a fund managed by Morgan Stanley? It was a 75-year, $1.1 billion deal.
Yes, and I think the Chicago example is a particularly important one for two reasons. One is it shows us an important distinction, and that is the difference between what we in the community call a brownfield lease and versus greenfield construction. So what the city of Chicago did is it took an existing set of assets, in this case it's street parking and the meters associated with those spaces, which already were generating revenue for the city, and they essentially put out a bid and let this private concessionaire come and make a bid on it to say, we will provide you with a one-time upfront lump sum payment, and in exchange you will hand off to us the stream of revenue that these parking spaces generate over the next 75 years, which is an incredible length of time. And so nothing, in a sense, new was created out of this deal. It was a transaction that the city engaged in order to try to take in some revenue at a time when the Great Recession was truly hammering the U.S. economy, and state and local governments and even the national government saw their tax receipts decline precipitously. So this was really a cash grab more than anything to do with the state of repair of our current system or the need to make certain kinds of targeted expansions. What's particularly troubling about that Chicago deal, I think, is One, it's just fundamentally undemocratic. You have one mayoral administration in time, which entered into an agreement for 75 years, which is incredibly long.
Wow.
And subsequent democratically elected mayors and city councils don't have any ability to amend that deal. They are essentially stuck with the terms of that deal. So no matter what happens politically, they're bound by those terms. On a day-to-day practical sense, it really constrains some of the planning that the city is able to engage in. So let's just take one example. If Chicago Transit Authority wanted to try to improve bus service along one of their major avenues through a process we often call bus rapid transit, which is to say providing a dedicated lane for that bus to try to speed up service, improve quality, and generate additional ridership, that might involve taking away parking spaces that have been around for a long time on that avenue and handing that lane over to the bus, particularly during the morning and evening commute periods. In order to invest in that kind of an improvement to bus service, the city of Chicago has to do one of two things. It either has to find a parking space on a road that has a roughly equivalent level of daily traffic and swap out one that they're taking away for the bus rapid transit project and give the concessionaire that other one, or they have to look at what the expected cash value of that space is over the remainder of that contract period and essentially hand the private company back the value of that spot. Now, if you're talking about a bus rapid transit line that might extend for a few miles, you could easily be talking about thousands of parking spaces that the city of Chicago is going to have to essentially buy out the position of this private concessionaire. So it has some troubling anti-democratic elements to it. It has some troubling implications for planning. It constrains what cities and regions are able to do. And I think that these, in particular, brownfield lease transactions where states and local governments are just trying to come up with cash quickly are particularly troubling.
And parking rates skyrocketed. What was the justification for these Dems in Chicago to sign a 75-year lease?
Well, I think this was principally driven by the mayor, and it was, in a sense, I think the path of least resistance. You were faced with the prospect of either making some rather draconian budget cuts, which would, you know, really affect city services, and of course they had to do some of that anyways, or fall back on the cash cushion that this brownfield lease transaction generated for the city. Having said that, that money has essentially all been spent, and now city residents are left with having to sort of deal with the fallout of this contract for decades to come. And I think there's another aspect embedded in this, and that is when you sign one of these lengthy agreements, part of what you have to do is try to peer out into the future and anticipate what sorts of changes your community or region might undergo. You want to try to anticipate them so that you can create contract provisions that provide you with, you know, the types of flexibility you think that you might need. But I think it's safe to say that it's a fool's errand to assume that any one governor or mayor could look 75 years into the future and have any sense of what is going to be needed. And so you are, in a sense, trying to negotiate and come up with contract provisions in an impossible task. Because you can't know that, you're going to lock yourself into something that 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years down the line turns out to be a terrible mistake, but is no way for you to know that at the time. So I think the nature of these agreements is troubling, and we have to scrutinize them heavily.
The Chicago Sun-Times had a piece last year called Parking Meters Garages Took in $156 million, but the city of Chicago will not see one penny of that money.
Right, and that's where I think it's easier to think about this transaction, in essence, as a loan. The private concessionaire gave the city, in effect, a loan for $1 billion. And the repayment of that loan comes from the cash that is generated by these parking spaces over the 75-year period of that lease. And so that's the nature of the transaction. It wasn't as though this was $1 billion for free, and sometimes these deals are pitched to the public as though it's found money. It's not found money. In a sense, it's just a loan. So when these private concessionaires bid on brownfield deals, they're looking at how much money they think it's going to generate over the term of the concession. They apply a discount rate to that, come up with what they think the net present value is, and then sort of throw a profit margin on top of it. And so that's where the city came up with this deal for $1 billion. But everybody who tries to park in Chicago is really the ones paying that loan back over the next 75 years.
The rates went from $3 an hour in 2008 to $6.50 an hour in 2013.
Mm-hmm. You know, and some of that is maybe okay if it's for a strategic benefit. So if a city is looking at an area where parking is particularly congested, if there is a great deal of congestion and fuel being wasted, people who are circling, unable to find parking because rates in a high demand era are artificially low, raising rates a certain amount in order to try to find, in a sense, an equilibrium between supply and demand and cost isn't a bad idea. In this case, it's rather uniform increases in parking in order to meet the repayment of that, what is in effect a loan, and to provide profit margin to this concessionaire. And so it's not being done out of a strategic goal from a public policy perspective, but rather just to satisfy the profit margins of these investors.
And how has the city of Chicago responded?
I think it would be safe to say that people aren't particularly happy with that, and it's one of the examples that tends to come up when we have conversations about public-private partnerships, because people feel like the deal that the city struck was particularly poor and one-sided. So I would say that it's not popular locally, and it has certainly served as a cautionary tale to other mayors and governors as they think about what they want to do with their facilities.
Kevin DeGood is Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress. And today we are talking about the infrastructure in the United States. The American Society of Civil Engineers' latest report card gave the U.S. a D+, D as in dog. The Trump administration plans to announce details of its $1 trillion 10-year plan later this year. We do know that it plans to offer tax incentives in exchange for public-private partnerships. So what are your thoughts on this plan to offer tax incentives? And then the big question in the coming months is going to be, where will the focus be? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about what happens when private equity firms get involved. In December of last year, the New York Times ran a five-part series, really extensive, incredible reporting about what's happening across the country. And one of the co-authors, Ben Protes, has a piece called In American Towns, Private Profits from Public Works. And one of his examples is about what happened in, I think it's Bayonne, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Bayonne.
Bayonne. And he writes that Wall Street jumped in to help financially desperate municipalities to make much-needed repairs. And it came with a very hefty price, not just to pay for new water pipes, but also to help the investors earn a nice return, according to the New York Times analysis. These contracts guarantee a specific amount of revenue. Water rates in Bayonne have risen 28% since Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, one of Wall Street's most storied private equity firms, teamed up with another company to manage the city's water system. City officials promised residents a four-year rate freeze that never materialized. In one measure of residents' distress because their bills went up so high, people are falling so far behind on payment that the city is placing liens against their homes. And the report goes on to say that in a typical private equity water deal, higher rates help the firms earn returns of anywhere from 8 to 18%, more than what a regular for-profit water company might expect. So what are your thoughts on these deals? And do you think we're going to see more like this with the Trump plan?
I think if the Trump plan is successful in pushing forward with their equity tax credit scheme, we will invariably see more of these deals. And part of the effect of those tax credits is to lower the cost of equity capital. So when an investor knows that they're going to receive the tax credits through this plan, again, should it ultimately come to be passed into law, in a sense, they're willing to take a lower return on investment on an annual basis, and that makes the equity capital a little bit cheaper from the state and local government's perspective. And I think that may make it slightly more likely that as governments are looking at different procurement options, that they might be slightly more likely to choose the public-private partnership model. I think it's important to understand, though, that that's a a distinction about the method of procurement and really not a statement about the overall level of construction activity. I think, again, it's important to come back to this notion that the municipal bond market is so robust. It has, again, $3.7 trillion in outstanding issuances. It's huge. So if borrowing were the issue, we would see more construction activity. So when you hear rather outsized claims from the Trump administration about the total number of jobs we expect to be created from this tax credit scheme, I think those are laughably high. There are no serious economists who would claim that the total net effect on construction activity from tax credits is going to be anywhere near what they claim it's going to be. But back to your specific question about Bayonne and that deal, one of the things that I think sometimes are lost in the criticisms of these deals is that even in the absence of a private concessionaire entering into one of these public-private partnerships with a local government agency, there would often have to be rate increases regardless, which isn't to say that the rate increases in Bayonne have been well executed or are fair. I would need to know a little bit more about the specifics of that deal and how it has played out in its initial few years. But the system in Bayonne was truly in a state of disrepair, and they had some problems with the public sector management. And so, again, there were going to have to be rate increases, and so that's why it's a little tricky in a sense. You're trying to look at that deal in the absence of knowing exactly what they would have been if the public sector had retained control of the project. One of the other points I think it's important to make about the Bayonne deal is that theirs is a distribution-only system, which is to say the pipes in Bayonne deliver potable water to people's houses and to businesses and take wastewater away, but they are not responsible for either generating that drinking water or for treating wastewater. They take those drinking water deliveries from other municipal providers that create it, and they deliver that wastewater to other systems that treat it before it's discharged back into waters of the U.S. So one of the things we talked about earlier was this notion of risk transfer, that part of why you might be okay with paying the premium associated with a public-private partnership is that under that fixed-price contract model, you're getting something in return. In this case, the system is an incredibly simple one. It's pipes that just do these deliveries of potable water to places and take wastewater away. There is, in a sense, no risk transfer to be had. So we have to ask ourselves, what is it that Bayonne is getting by paying this, you know, 10 to 20% annual rate of return on that equity capital? And I have my skepticisms about whether or not they're really getting much for that.
Well, if you'd like to read more about this particular deal and others that the New York Times highlighted, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. According to PitchBook, a private financial data platform, there are 84 active financial infrastructure funds, up 25% in just 3 years. The Times reports that some belong to the big banks like Goldman Sachs, but many are run by private equity firms. Kevin, have you looked at any of these projects that actually operate in the public interest?
Yes, I think, you know, a lot of those funds, to be clear, are not necessarily focused on the U.S. market. We have very few public-private partnership deals on a per capita basis, and part of that comes back to the fact that the municipal bond market has this unique tax treatment. People who purchase municipal bonds don't pay income taxes on the interest income that they earn on an annual basis, and that's part of why municipal bond debt is so cheap. As a result of that, many state and local governments don't choose to use private equity capital, don't choose to enter into public-private partnerships. As a result, there are very few deals for Wall Street to bid on. Oftentimes, when you look at the prospectus statement for these infrastructure funds, what you find is that they have a focus in one of two places, either abroad, where other countries don't have the same tax treatment of their public sector debt, and you tend to get more bank debt or equity debt as part of infrastructure deals, or domestically, they tend to be focused heavily on the energy sector, which again is just private business activity, and we sort of judge those deals on a different set of metrics than we would on the public sector.
Just to jump in, because we're almost out of time, can you point to any projects that are working well where the rates maybe didn't jump, so people aren't getting liens on their homes and are actually working in the public for the public's best interest?
That's a good question. I don't have any deals that come right to the top of my mind, but I don't know, maybe the hot lanes here in the I-95 corridor just south of Washington, D.C., as well as the Beltway hot lanes. I think people feel like those deals were pretty well done and well executed, and the tolling has been reasonable. But part of it depends on an ex post look back to see whether or not the concessionaire actually earned the rates of return that were targeted as part of the deal, or whether or not revenues actually fell short. So sometimes you can't know on the front end until you've had a number of years go by to look at the financial performance to see if people are, in a sense, overpaying for the facility that they received.
We have an email from Gray Brecken, who's a project scholar at the Living New Deal, and he says that public infrastructure should be discussed since it got us out of the Great Depression, and we've been using it ever since while letting it fall into ruin at our great peril. He says that Trump's plan is yet more of his moonshine. It's entirely inadequate as well as impossible given Republican budgetary constraints.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. People who feel like adding infrastructure into any discussion of tax reform will make it easier to pass, I think, are fooling themselves. Adding infrastructure to a tax package makes the overall cost of it go up. And I think there are going to be a lot of problems, particularly with the same folks in the House Freedom Caucus who balked at the American Healthcare Act. And the price tag of that and the changes involved are not going to be too happy with trying to spend a bunch of money on infrastructure. And I think there are very few, if any, Democrats who are going to look at that package and be bought off by a few dollars for infrastructure, particularly if those dollars happen to be in the form of tax credits for wealthy equity investors.
And when you look at the history of infrastructure projects and public infrastructure projects, we've come a long way since then. I mean, things have changed a lot. What really strikes you when you look at the history?
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that we're just at a fundamentally different place in our national development that we were in the 1930s when we look back at some of the aspects of the New Deal or the early days of the interstate highway construction era. We have reaped a lot of the benefits of those investments, and we have now this fairly world-class system of infrastructure. Granted, it needs a great deal of money spent in repair, but we have, in a sense, achieved many of the efficiency gains that those types of investments can provide for us. And so when we think about what are going to be the returns now, I think they're fundamentally lower because we're making improvements at the margin. We're not starting from a system where, you know, it took somebody 3 weeks to try to drive across country because the roads were so bad. Our system is better than that, and it's more efficient than that. So part of what that tells us is that some of the low-hanging fruit has already been plucked, and we have to be smarter and more targeted in the investments that we make to truly be sure that we're gaining a greater return than what we're putting in as taxpayers.
We have the Trump plan. They want to offer tax incentives in exchange for public-private partnerships. The Democrats say the plan should be paid for by closing tax loopholes used by corporations and super wealthy individuals. What do you think of that one?
Well, one of the ideas that Trump administration has floated and some of the members of the House have floated is this notion of a repatriation, which is really just a huge giveaway to multinational corporations that have stashed money overseas on transactions, and they're looking for this window of kind of tax forgiveness to open up so that they can bring some of this money back on shore. And really that's a fleecing of all of us, because if they bring that money back in now, they pay the 35% tax rate, and if we work out one of these deals where we try to take some of that money and stick it into an infrastructure bill or to try to pay for part of tax reform, we're really giving them a huge break on their overall tax liability. So that's not really something that we support, and I think that there are plenty of other places in the tax code where we have giveaways and inefficiencies, and we should look to those places first as a method to pay for any infrastructure investment.
Kevin DeGood is Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can find more information about the state of the infrastructure in the United States at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Sadie Gribben is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.